Okay, we're 1 Corinthians chapter 11 today, 1 Corinthians 11, and we left off around verse 11, I believe. We just talked about this concept of the woman not praying or prophesying with her head not down or not covered, the necessity of her demonstrating in the assembly her submission to her own husband, the fact that she is in submission to him, and not that this fact is restraining her ministry. In other words, there's no indication here that the woman is to change the way she prophesies because of this. She's prophesying the word of God. So, you know, see, I think the worry that might come to women might be, well, if I have to show my submission to my husband, even in the assembly, does that mean that I'm not really free to minister the way God's called me to minister? Absolutely not. God is wanting us to be free to minister. You see, God's restrictions upon our behavior have no restriction upon the way he's going to move. He doesn't move contrary to his own law. He doesn't forbid, he's not going to choke out himself. You know, I mean, if he's establishing certain guidelines, he's not going to be hindered by those. In fact, they will enhance the freedom and the liberty. I mean, we're finding out that the more we draw into conformity to the law of God by the Spirit of God that's working within us, the greater liberty we have. The greater liberty. We're free from sin, not free to sin. And so he's saying then that that this is to be observed because of the... He says that it's not just a matter of custom. It's not just a matter of making everybody happy. It's a matter of their involvement with spirit beings that are going to seek to take advantage of any kind of unsubmission on the part of the wife to the husband, and will fan that to a flame, because of course the demons themselves are rebels, and they're always looking for any kind of indication or any kind of an outward show or outward sign, whatever this was, as far as, you know, putting the hair on the top of the head or whatever, that they were not in submission. He would fan that to a flame. Make sure you keep the power on your head, authority on your head, because of the angels. And the angels of God are also going to work to enhance that and bring blessing and bring power in our lives as we are in conformity to the Word of God. Okay, well, we covered that basically. In verse 11, we left off with the thought that nevertheless is the man, and neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the Lord. Now he talks about the fact that men and women are interdependent. They can't stand alone. He's balancing the above, lest men treat their wives wrongly, unless they think, well, it's all the wife's fault, and if she'll submit and so forth. See, man has a responsibility also. Ephesians chapter 5, in fact, is dealing both with the husband and the wife. Wife, submit yourself to the husband and the Lord, but it says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ so loved the church and gave himself for it. And there's a mutual responsibility. You're never going to get a marriage problem solved if only one person does what's right, and the other one remains contrary to God. Usually what will happen, if one person will start it and do what God's called them to do, the other person will begin to respond in kind. But if they don't, you still don't get anywhere. You know, you still don't get at least the marriage, the thing accomplished the way God intended. So they are interdependent. The man needs the woman just as the woman needs the man. And he can't stand alone as far as God's plan is concerned in the general. Now, we've seen some exceptions to that in 1 Corinthians 7, that Paul did talk about a man having a special gift and so forth. But we want to see those as exceptions because of present distress, not the general rule. And so in the assembly, he's talking about the relationship between men and women and their interdependence. In the assembly, I mean, imagine having church services in which the women were not allowed to do anything. Some very intensely legalistic churches where they get into this kind of thing, women are pressed down to the point where, I mean, about all they can talk about is babies, you know. I mean, if they even dare to talk about spiritual things, they are squelched immediately. They're not to speak in the church, you see. And that is never the heart of God. Here, the woman is prophesying, and that's what the whole issue is. He's not talking about whether she can speak or not. It's talking about the manner and the decorum and the testimony and the expression of that testimony of a relationship to her husband. That relationship to her husband should be manifest to the assembly. In other words, it's a testimony to all. It's an example of the Christ in the church. Every one of us are broadcasting something. Every one of you that is married is showing forth something to your brethren in the way that you are treating your husband or your wife, the way that your marriage is showing forth something about what has happened in you, what your heart is really like before God. It's a testimony. And it is a testimony to the world. And many people are drawn to Christ by seeing a marriage that is working right. That's one of the things that you see most rarely out in the world. Most of the time out in the world, I don't know whether the ratio is, you know, one out of every two that ends in divorce now, at least last figures I heard, and it's rising. And even the ones that are staying together, it's just barely, usually. Or it's a matter of convenience, or it's because of the kids, or it's because of this or that. You just don't see very frequently a real, genuinely good marriage out there. And God wants to demonstrate that in us. We've got an opportunity here. We need to take advantage of it. And because the Lord's been dealing with us on that subject, you know, I can't help but you know, add some more punch to it here. And God has made us to be complementary, not independent. There's the point. We're not to be independent of one another. A man should not go off into his ministry independent of his wife, just tagging her. She just tags along. She should be integrally involved in everything that he's doing. He should be sharing his heart with. She's a strength to him. She's a glory unto him. And he needs to recognize that. He needs to include her in his heart and his thoughts. Christ is including us. He's sharing with us his innermost heart. He's sharing with us the secrets of God. The manifold wisdom of God is being made known through the church. He's revealing these things to us. He delights to reveal his heart to us. And so a husband should delight to reveal his heart to his wife. And the wife is dependent upon him, of course, in the senses that we've already discussed. Interdependence. They need one another. So, nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the Lord. Now it goes on in verse 12, for as the woman is of the man, see, even so is the man also by the woman, but all things of God. Now the woman is of the man. We talked about that back up in verse 9, how that he's referring to creation, referring to the fact that the woman was created out of the side of man. And so the woman is out of the man. But even so is the man also by the woman. You see, since the time of Adam, every man has come out of a woman's womb. And so men, all men are dependent upon a woman, just as the woman was originally dependent upon man. God has interwoven this thing beautifully. Because, you know, there's... You can argue, well, what's more important, a man or a woman? And, you know, the man can say, you know, the woman could say, well, if without women, you know, there wouldn't be any men, you know. And the man can say, well, without men, there wouldn't be any either, you know. And, you see, God has made us interdependent. And this is so important. It's so important to realize it as a basis of a relationship between a man and a woman, that they need to recognize their mutual need for the other. Not that, well, the man can go along his way and he kind of takes the woman along. He kind of condescends to take care of a woman, you know, and she's got needs and all of this, and he'll condescend to take care of that. He needs to know that he needs her. He needs her. People are starting to find out how much they need one another. They really need that relationship. And she was created from Adam's side. But all men, of course, come through a woman. But the prepositions are interesting here, too. The word used in verse 12, the beginning, for as the woman is of the man, that's ek, out of the man. The woman is out of the man. And that's referring to her creation from Adam's side. But then the man is by the woman. The Greek is through, dia, through the woman. The man comes through the woman in childbirth. And so it's not saying only that the man is out of the woman because he comes through the woman. You see, it's dealing with the male seed and the female seed both, but it comes through the woman, and it's a necessity to have the woman there. There would be no men, you know, or women in the world without that. It reminds me of in Timothy, where it talks about the woman is saved in childbearing, tying it back to the promise that was made in Genesis that through the seed of the woman, the Messiah would come. And God has done the same thing there in terms of our salvation. You know, a person could say, well, Jesus was a man, male, and therefore salvation came through the male, and it didn't come through women. Women don't have much to do with the plan of salvation. It's been the male. But the emphasis in the scriptures was it was the seed of woman, and it was through the human lineage was through a woman. And so God worked both with man and woman. I mean, there's no, to compensate for the fact that the woman was the one that was deceived, God worked through the woman to bring salvation. He's doing this kind of thing all the time, so that nobody needs feel rejected. Nobody needs feel, well, I was born a woman, I got a raw deal in life. Or I was born a man, and I wish I'd been born a woman or something, you know. Nobody ever needs to feel that way. Demons will like to try to press you that way, of course. And demons of homosexuality and other things to try to pervert it. But there's a beautiful interdependence here. And he says, all things are of God. The last clause is, ultimately, everything comes from God. Ek, in the Greek is ek, out of. Everything comes out of God. God's the source of man and woman, and the source of their means of propagation, and the source of their created interdependence. Okay. Verse 13, judge in yourselves, is it comely that a woman pray unto God uncovered? Judge in yourselves, he says. He appeals to their own reason, based on nature itself, to show the submission of the woman to man. And this is interesting because we'll pursue this for a few verses here, the next verse too, that he's appealing to something natural. He's appealing to something within you, something that he feels should be built into every man and woman, that they intrinsically should have a feeling about this subject, that intrinsically they should know that a woman should be in submission to man, and that nature itself should tell us that. So he's appealing to what's in their very created being. And if they're normal, and if they haven't been perverted by the devil into homosexuality or something like that, they are going to recognize and sense that it's proper for this relationship to be manifested this way. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the actual external sign itself is going to be something that they would intuitively expect. But whatever the society and the culture interprets as being submission, they should in their hearts feel that that is right. That's what it should be. This word uncovered is in the Greek not covered down, the same word that's used above. So if the woman is uncovered, not covered down, and praying unto God uncovered, it's uncomely. Nature itself should dictate that to us. Now, verse 14, doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him? Again, he's appealing to nature, that which is natural, that which is built into man, that which is built in perhaps as a part of conscience or the knowledge of good and evil. It's hard to know exactly what he's appealing to in detail, but it's part of the very basic difference between men and women. And we know that there are intrinsic genetic differences, not only physically, physiologically, but emotionally in other areas, between men and women. So Paul's appealing to their common sense and their understanding of life. And God has made man stronger and rougher and so forth than the woman, able to take more external abuse, that type of thing. And the woman is, in general, weaker, softer, more delicate, physically and emotionally. And the man is generally, now these are general things, but generally he's more oriented toward logic and rationale and better able to think abstractly. And these are things that psychologists have observed for years, and you know, you can find all kinds of books about it. But it's something, you know, I remember observing too when we were in junior high school and dealing in mathematics, I guess in elementary school. It seemed like the girls were always better in math because they seemed to be more accurate as far as adding and subtracting and multiplying and dividing. And but as soon as we got to algebra, we started to see a marked change. Because once you start to getting into abstracts, A's, B's, and C's, X, Y's, and Z's, instead of things that, you know, you can touch and feel and handle, and, you know, once you get into abstract thought, then it starts to shift. And once you get into calculus, you know, you're talking about the limit as a number approaches to zero, and you know, and this other number approaching infinity, and you know, having to picture things in a pictorial way and orientation that way. There aren't very many women that really are drawn by that, and really get excited about that. You know, I can get excited about things like that, but my wife, I can tell her things like that, and she just does not. You know, she loves me and she'll listen. You know, but you know, you can tell it's not moving her to tears. You know. But it doesn't take hold. They're not used to thinking that way. Their life and orientation is more toward, you know, especially people and people's feelings and so forth. And not that men are cold and indifferent, but they are their lives having to deal with, you know, being the breadwinner and being the one that's in a position. He's got to deal more in terms of concepts and so forth. And it's fortunate, you know, that a man is not as emotionally moved as a woman in areas, and if he just breaks down into tears anytime anything happens on the job or something, I mean, he's not going to be able to hold up very long. Somebody in the family's got to have that kind of strength, and then you got to have the one with the compassion and so forth to enhance that. This is again that interdependence, the complementary nature between them. And of course, it's not all black and white. You don't have a stoic and then an emotional fanatic, you know, joined together. You got to have a balance in it. But the emphasis, you see, and the sensitivities will vary in general. And So the woman is going to be, in general, more emotional, more sensitive. She's thinking more in terms of details, more in terms of visible, tangible things, more in terms of people and relationships and things than the man is. And part of it is just because of the way that she's living and the environment that she's in, but a lot of it is very, very deeply ingrained in the genetic system. I mean, you watch it, the differences in little boys and little girls very early. Now, because of this, it's natural, then, for the man to have the short hair, signifying authority. Not covering his head, which is a type of his authority. Now, the argument has sometimes come, well, nature itself, does not nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it's a shame unto him? But some will say, well, if a man doesn't do anything with his hair, if he just lets it be natural, it'll be long. And therefore, nature would give man long hair. And therefore, what's Paul saying here? I think what he's talking about is not the nature of how long your hair grows. You know, otherwise you could say, you know, you should have a full face beard, and you should never cut your fingernails, and you know, everything else. I mean, let nature have its course, you know. But God is expecting us to do some bodily maintenance, you know, and take care of the body that we have. And there is the thing that he's really getting at is not the nature of how your body grows, or what your body, you know, how long your hair would naturally grow. The nature is the nature within you of recognition of the position of the man as opposed to the woman in the marriage relationship, and the man being the head. That's the nature he's appealing to. He's appealing to the fact that everybody inside knows that the man is the stronger one physically and the stronger one emotionally, and he should be the one to be the head in the family. God has created that as a strength to the woman. And therefore, nature should tell you that it's a shame for a man to have long hair. Why? Because long hair signifies submission and looks like a woman. And nature should tell you a man shouldn't look like a woman. That's the thing he's trying to say. Nature should tell you that a man should not look like a woman. A man should not have his hair long like a woman's and show submission. That's what nature's telling you. And so he's appealing to something. And you see, again, we're looking at something beyond custom now. He says nature itself should tell you. Not just the customs of the day, but nature itself. The nature of recognition of the position of the man and the woman. Now, there's no proof that Jesus or anyone in the Old Testament or New Testament had long hair, as far as men. Many times you get arguments, well, Jesus had long hair, and the proof of that is the pictures that they buy in the Bible bookstore, you know. And there it is, he had long hair. Or they saw, what was some of the movies that were made about the life of Christ, greatest story ever told, whatever, some of the, you know, they show them every Easter. You know, in some cases he had long blonde hair and blue eyes, you know. And a lot of the Catholic pictures, from what I understand, they even used women to be the models to pose for the pictures. And they make him soft and kind of milky and effeminate, you know. And so contrary. I mean, somebody like that didn't go in and crack the whip and drive the money changers out of the temple. You know what I mean? The picture we find in the Gospels is certainly not effeminacy at all. But that's the way they're characterizing it. There is no proof that Jesus had long hair. In fact, I think you've got abundant proof that he could not have had long hair. Can you imagine? This Apostle Paul is writing this, I don't know what date we gave for this, 54, something like that, A.D. So we're talking about 30 years or so after the time that Christ was on the earth and ministering. Can you imagine him saying, it's a shame for a man to have long hair, if Jesus had long flowing locks, you know, and all the disciples with their long hair. What happened? You know, did Paul institute something new? All the men get haircuts now? Not at all. And he's not saying something different. Jesus didn't have long hair. Now, by long, of course, we get into the question of what the line is. I can't say that his hair was as short as ours, but I can certainly say that his hair was not long in comparison to a woman's hair. Now, there are some mentioned in the Old Testament that did have long hair, though. I mean, you can prove that some people in the Old Testament had long hair. Absalom, for one. You know, and I don't know if we really want to identify with him. And his long hair got him in trouble, too. He got caught in the trees and lost his life as a result of it. But that wasn't so much the hair, but the symbol of the rebellion that he was manifesting by that. Samson had long hair, but he had a Nazirite vow. And see, the fact that there was a Nazirite vow that said to not cut the hair showed that that was an unusual thing. The Nazirite vow was not that everybody didn't have a Nazirite vow, which means that the normal was to have short hair. The Nazirite vow was unusual not to cut his hair. And the Nazirite vow is in Numbers 6, verses 1 to 21. Numbers 6, verses 1 to 21, specifically verses 1, 2, and 5. Specifically verses 1, 2, and 5. And what was the Nazirite vow? It was a special vow of submission to God. And the submission to God is being symbolized by the long hair. Now I've heard it argued that Jesus had a Nazirite vow. And therefore, he had long hair, even though the others in his day didn't. Well, that's easy to disprove. Because the Nazirite vow also said that they were never to drink wine. Jesus drank wine. He obviously didn't have a Nazirite vow. Spiritually, he had a Nazirite vow. See, that Nazirite vow was spiritually pointing to Christ. He was in submission to his Father in a way that no one else was, but it wasn't the physical Nazirite vow. It was the spiritual that he partook of. And if he had long hair, Paul would have made this statement. Okay, was there a question down here? Yes.
No, this is not a great question. I wondered about it. If to have a Nazirite vow, would they really good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
the Nazarite vow involved entailed a lot of other things. As you read the whole description of that, it was a good thing, but it was not the thing that that God was, you know, signifying for everyone. The point was that there was a special dedication made for a purpose of ministry and so forth that was to be done, and there aren't a lot of examples of a person, you know, being in that position, and it was a special being set apart unto God. Now, of course, this was in the Old Testament, so you're dealing with types and shadows. In the New Testament, we find no example of anybody portraying it that way. But it was a type. The Old Testament was full of signs and shadows. And of course, it was not an evil thing to have long hair in this connotation if they had a Nazarite vow. But to wear your hair like a woman's hair and not be in a position of a Nazarite vow, that was something entirely different. And even so, the long hair on Samson, for example, set him apart, and of course he was manifesting. And what was he manifesting? He was manifesting strength and masculinity, you know, demonstrating the power of God there. And so there was nothing effeminate about him. There was nothing trying to identify with women. This was a special vow unto God, and it was understood in the society and the culture as being such. Now, if today we had a Nazarite vow and a special situation, you know, and people were engaged in that honestly before God, there wouldn't be the problem. I mean, everybody would recognize that that's what it is. But the men wearing long hair today isn't because they've got some Nazarite vow, you know. It's not that I've got some special vow unto the Lord, you know, and I would ask, you know, what about the other parts of the Nazarite vow, too? I mean, if you're going to take this literally, and of course, this is fulfilled in Christ anyway. So the argument really doesn't hold any weight at all. The fact that the long hair is symbolizing submission, and God is telling us here it's a shame for a man to have long hair now in the New Testament, lets us know what the instruction is. And we look in the Old Testament now to find an example to try to undo that. The example doesn't undo it. The example was under the Old Testament under a specific law and a specific dispensation to illustrate a certain truth that was not seen by everybody. Everybody didn't say, well, boy, it sure looks, you know, those Nazarite guys really look slick with that long hair. Let's all do that too, you know. It would have been an abomination to the Lord if they'd done that, without making that vow and dedicating their whole lives to that.
Mm-hmm. What, how did the tradition that we have, like the reason that I know that we have pictures of Jesus with long hair is because of the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did they come up with, why did men start wearing long hair? Do you have any idea?
All I can say is there were probably demons of, you know, the same kind of demons that are floating around today. Demons of homosexuality, demons of perversion, and so forth, to press these things. Because at the time of the Renaissance, they were opening up to all kinds of demonic ideas, all kinds of lies.
Even before then, though, men were wearing long hair, and you can tell by the paintings and different
stuff.
And it went all the way up to about early 1800s.
Yeah. It's hard, you know, I don't know if anybody's done a, you know, a detailed study on that, or if there's even any historical information that we can say why this came in. There probably are reasons. And see, in other words, what you're saying is if in the time of the Bible they weren't wearing long hair, and, you know, the pictures that we have on Romans and Egyptians and others, the men are basically having short hair too, I mean, at least in the Roman period and the Greek period. So there wasn't any evidence there that they were, you know, you don't see the Caesars. The Caesars are always picking, you've seen the busts of the Caesars, and so forth, it was always very short, quite short hair. And so that wasn't prevalent at that time. So what happened in history to change it? I really can't tell you in detail, except that I smell demons, you know. In other words, they're always trying to pervert. Even the clothing styles in France, in the, you know, Louis the 14th, and all the clothing styles were so effeminate. And it's not just a matter of being, you know, beautiful, lots of bright colors and things, but the styles and the ruffles and the, you know, the and the way the men versus the women were dressing and so forth. There's just a lot of that kind of an element that was coming in there. And when you connect that with all of the other philosophies and ideologies that came in, it was fitting. So and you know, some will say, well, George Washington had long hair, you know, therefore, you know, but I could say, well, Abraham Lincoln had short hair, you know. So what, you know, and the custom of the time. And a lot of them did, even they would wear these wigs, these powdered wigs and things too, that their hair really wasn't that long, but they wore the wig if it wasn't. And it was the custom of the time, and it wasn't something that God was condoning. So there's been a lot of, and of course, right today, we've gotten more of a swing toward conservatism, and you don't see that many men out there in the world, in the business world with long hair. A few years ago, you know, it's funny to even look at pictures taken back in the late 60s and early 70s and so forth and see how prevalent that was. kind of gotten used to it not being that way. I'm kind of thankful for that. But every once in a while you see it, and it kind of even stands out now, even among the hippies out there. You don't see that very frequently anymore. And there's all kinds of, you know, if you're trying to get a job and so forth, they tell you, you know, don't wear long hair, don't wear a mustache and beard and so forth. A lot of them are finding out that for economic reasons, they want to eat, you know, they better shape up. And find out people aren't thrilled with that long hair. Now they're in the business world, even worldly people. Okay. Now verse 15. But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. So this is a verse I mentioned before. It's the only specific statement in here that tells us something about what was a covering. The hair is given to her for a covering. So if there's any question about what the covering was, this specifically states it. And we know that this will be a covering. Whether or not there was a veil or something is really immaterial. But the hair is a glory to her because it shows her submission. Now, of course, we want to be careful here that we don't make women feel like, unless you've got the prettiest hairstyle and the longest hair in the church, you know, that, you know, the length of hair is associated with your spirituality. That's not the point at all. The point is that the hair should be long enough to be a covering. It should be long enough to make it quite obvious that you're a woman, not a man, and that you're thankful that you're in that position of submission. And the fact that the woman wears her hair long, the fact that she wants it that way, is showing her willingness to be submitted. And it's interesting that in the women's lib movement, they feel like cutting their hair short. And a lot of real short, mannish-type hairstyles, wearing mannish-type suits and so forth, going to go out in the business world like the men, and, you know, become a fireman and a policeman and everything like the men. And try to do all those things. I think it's the most pathetic thing that I've ever seen is to see a woman being forced into a position by the demons and by the pressures of a perverted society into a position that she really can't be happy in. She really can't function the way she needs to. And they're always making compensations, and the men are always having to come and really do the work. It's really sad. It's sad to put a woman in that position. A lot of them are proud of the position, but down inside, if you could see them down inside. I mean, look at the things we're finding out about ourselves as God begins to open up our hearts. How many of those people, you know, what would they really be saying if their hearts could be expressed? See, God has created us not in vain. He's created these differences between men and women for a reason, for a purpose, and you can't just pretend they're not there. They're obviously there. And we need to work in conformity with what he's had. If we're going to achieve ultimate happiness, we're going to have to be in conformity with the way we're designed and not pervert it. Now, if a woman has been given long hair instead of a covering, in fact, the Greek says, the word for a covering here, the Greek is instead of a covering, instead of a thing thrown around, literally, some kind of a veil or something. Her hair has been given to her instead of a veil, apparently, is what the Greek is saying, instead of a covering, some sort of a covering. In other words, to me, that's saying you don't need a veil. Your hair is given to you for that purpose. And if some are going to argue that she's got to have a veil on too, it says their hair is given to her instead of a veil. Now, if a woman has been given long hair instead of a cloth covering, then she is covered, and she satisfies the absolute sense of the principle being laid down here. She is covered down. If she's got long hair and she's prophesying and her hair is obviously a testimony to the fact that she's covered, she is satisfying the scripture. And she doesn't need a piece of cloth on her head in addition to that, regardless of whether or not they actually had a veil or not. They may have had one. I don't know. There's no proof that they did. But if they did, it's certainly not spoken here in the scripture. And it's certainly not required. The only thing that he tells us that is a covering is the hair. And therefore, if the hair is the covering, and if her hair is covering and doing what it was the sign was intended to convey, she is in conformity with the scripture in that area. Okay, so there is no requirement or implication of a requirement for women today to wear veils or hats or something on their head in church. Now, in a given society, however, and I want to add this to this, because in different times, in different climes, different societies, different cultures, if an additional outward apparel or hairstyle is used to further express the fact that the woman is in submission to her husband, and if it's understood that way by the society, and such as veils or whatever, it would be wrong to violate that custom in the churches. If you're doing it every other time and then go to church and say, no, I'm not going to wear this in church because I'm, bless God, I'm not in submission to my husband in church. If they're doing that, they're violating the principle. In other words, if they're willing to do certain things as far as showing a custom elsewhere during the rest of their lives, they need to do it in church also. In other words, the point is that going to church and being in the assembly does not pull a woman out from under the covering of her husband. That's, I think, what he's really getting at. She still shows that sign. So our society is less restrictive right now. We don't have a lot of customs associated with this. In an earlier age, there may have been more. But we would have to we'll qualify this by saying that if you found yourself ministering in another country, ministering someplace where the customs of the people throughout the nation involved a certain sign of submission or something, you would have to consider maintaining that in the assembly also, at least at first, until more teaching could come, until you get them out of it, if it's associated with paganism or something, until you get them taught. The basic point is that the women should be always showing that and demonstrating that in the way that's understood and received by society. Okay. Now verse 16, he says, "But if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God." So this is telling us that if any man still wants to be debating the matter, if any man seems to be contentious, if he still doesn't agree and he wants to have his long hair or whatever, wants to have the woman to have her hair up on top of her head or whatever, Paul is appealing to the common custom of the apostles and the other churches of women observing the sign of submission. So he's saying, in effect, if you disagreed, if you want to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. We're all doing it this way, and it's showing forth a certain sign. And even if they disagree on the matter, they should submit because of the general custom of the day. And there's no reason for them to step out from under that, even if they disagree. It's not going to violate their conscience to submit to this. And this statement indicates that this is not a matter of infinite spiritual importance either, but of good witness and proper conduct. And he's trying to say we have no other such custom, And this is what we're trying to portray. This is a rule that he's making in the church to try to avoid a problem. And this is not going to be, it's not going to be that you lose your soul if the woman's hair is too short or something. That's not the point. He's not trying to be legalistic, but we have no other custom. Don't be contentious about this and try to stir up a division in the body of Christ over this matter. Okay, now verse 17. "Now in this that I declare unto you, I praise you not, that ye come together not for the better but for the worse." Now he's addressing a new problem, and it's going to involve communion. And in this that I declare, this is starting a new section now, that which follows. "In this that I declare, I praise you not." He doesn't give them any commendation, in other words, with regard to what he's about to say. Yes, Chris?
One last question.
Okay.
The topic.
Yes.
If you were out ministering or you were in a different city or something,
yeah,
with your wife or whatever, and you were invited to like a PC shirt.
Right. Yeah, I would try to find out what the situation was, especially if I was ministering. If I was visiting, I try to kind of meet her. Sometimes, even those churches, they recognize that visitors that come in just to hear aren't going to be quite in the same position. But if I was ministering, for example, if I would say they invited me to preach or teach or speak, I would want to make sure that my wife was in a position where she was not offending them. In other words, whatever they were, if she had to wear her hair up or if she had to, put a veil on or something, I would have no problem with that. There's no reason to give any offense on that issue. Try to make that an issue. And we've had that situation on outreaches, for example, where we've had to conform to the, if we've ministered in UPC churches, there's no reason to offend them, have them looking at you all the time being upset while you're trying to minister to them. It doesn't do any good. And it didn't bother us to do it anyway. So what? That doesn't mean that from now on we're going to do that. It just means that for their benefit. That's a good example of what we saw earlier in 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. Yeah. If I was in doubt, I would go ahead and conform, if it was reasonable to conform to it. In other words, if it was going to require your wife going to the beauty parlor and spending $20 to get a fancy hairdo, I might reconsider that. I'd probably say, "Pastor, can you have some mercy on us? We're not used to this." And if he says no, well, we'll just have to find another church. it would depend on the situation. I don't think even if the UPC is really legalistic about it, if you're coming to visit, I think almost anybody recognizes. Now, the kind of people we have come in, the way they're dressed and so forth to visit our services sometimes, they certainly don't conform to the standards that we're establishing, and yet we recognize, how can they? We want to get their souls saved. We want to get their hearts affected and then deal with the other later. And I would expect that to be the case in general. If it's not, they've got more problems than I thought. All right. Now, in verse 17, introducing this next problem, he says, "I praise you not." Now, this is an antithesis to verse 2. Remember back up in verse 2, he says, "Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the ordinances I delivered them unto you." So he starts the chapter out with commendation in dealing with this first situation. But now he says, "In this I praise you not." now I've got something that I can't give you any good marks for, that you come together not for the better but for the worse. Now that would really be, can you imagine coming together, coming to church, and ending up worse than you were when you came? And this is a problem. In other words, this is de-edification instead of edification. And if you keep getting de-edified instead of edified, you know you're going to end up in shambles. So what was the reason why they were being unedified instead of edified? It had to do with the attitudes in their hearts with regard to each other in their communion. And having to do with the rich and the poor and the rich despising the poor and so forth. We'll get into the details in just a minute. But he says that you become together for the better, not for the better, but for the worse. Their fellowship and coming together was not for the better as it should be for edification, but for the worse because of divisions between them and because of abuses concerning the Lord's Supper, which he described shortly. Now, this matter of divisions between them that we talked about in the earlier parts of the chapters, chapter 1 and so forth, about some saying I'm of Apollos and I'm of Cephas, etc., that apparently was being manifested in their communions as well. And so when they were taking communion, there were little cell groups. The group of Cephas was over here, and the group of Apollos was over here, etc. And what a mockery to the whole concept of communion, that while they're taking communion, they're manifesting the divisions among them. And when communion is supposed to show that we're one, here they are, you know, here's the Cephas group over here, you know, maybe posting signs, all those of Cephas, you go over here, and all those, you know. I'm sure they didn't do that, but the kind of an attitude that was manifested was clear. In other words, he's going to talk about the fact that it was quite clear, they made it quite clear, that who they were of, and they would flock together with certain kinds in their clique. In addition to that, there was a problem with regard to the fact that some were wealthy and some were poor, and apparently this communion involved a meal, a feast that they would bring food to and so forth and have first before or after they took the emblems. And the rich would bring great sumptuous feast, and the poor, you know, would have hardly anything, and the rich weren't sharing with the poor, and there was another manifestation of what their hearts were. Yes? Well, the term love feast is used later on in some other scriptures. That term isn't used here, but it appears, many of the commentators feel that that's what was happening. In other words, it was a time where they were supposed to be expressing their love one to another, their unity and the fellowship, and I suppose, you know, the term isn't used here, but the concept is certainly that they are supposed to be, and that's what our communion is supposed to be, koinonia, joint participation, sharing. And so whether or not they were using that term here, that's not the term that Paul chose to use, but apparently the concept was the same. They were to be loving one another and showing and fellowshipping together, and apparently having a meal. In other words, what I'm saying is it was more than just a normal church service where they would just have communion as a part of the church service. Apparently there was a meal there in addition to communion because of the fact that he talks about some having plenty to eat and some not having, you know. And when we take communion, we don't pile on, you know, one person gets 10 pieces of bread and, you know, a gallon of juice, and the other person gets a little bit, and we don't do that. So apparently involved something in addition to that, a meal that they were having, and so that suggests that it was, you know, some sort of a meeting, either a prayer meeting or just a fellowship type of thing where they were all together and eating the meals together and then taking communion. Okay. That doesn't necessarily mean that we ought to adopt that today. In other words, when we have communion service, have a big meal. So the logistics of doing that for 3,000 people. I mean, we have a hard enough time getting the basic communion across, let alone doing that. Of course, we do have fellowships and other times for that to take place. But that's perhaps why a lot of detail isn't stated here. You can kind of read between the lines and see generally what was happening, but there's not a statement that this is the way this ought to be done. The things that ought to be done are clear-cut, and over and above that, there may be a lot of other ramifications. Yes?
I may be confused, but I thought that the churches were like individual, small churches.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
no, apparently not. Apparently not. Apparently they're within the church. Now, exactly how, there may have been individual meetings and so forth, too, but apparently this is talking about these divisions being manifest when they're all gathered together here. And this 1 Corinthians 11 is a pretty strong indication of that. Now, even so, we don't necessarily need to talk, we're not necessarily talking about thousands of people here. The church in Corinth, just how many people were there, you know, there's nothing indicating for sure here, but the fact that they are all gathering, I would guess, I mean, if I'm picturing the church in Corinth at this time, at this particular time in history, I'm thinking maybe a few hundred, you know, not thousands and thousands of them. although they were to grow and so forth and move. And, of course, as they would grow, then you might start seeing that phenomena taking place. But hopefully, I'm sure Paul's heart is to get these divisions taken care of before that ever happens, before they ever get isolated to the point where they've got another whole assembly over here, and this assembly is of Apollos, and another whole assembly over here that's of Cephas, and so forth. That doesn't appear to be the situation here. It appears that within one body, there was friction between members within the body over this issue. Yes?
Well, I was also under the same impression, not necessarily exactly like that, but like when Paul wrote letters to Corinth and Galatia, that there wasn't just one assembly, but many assemblies.
Well, in many places it was, and they were to circulate the epistles, you know, and it's like I say, there may be more involved here, but we're not... Remember, many of these churches are very young. They're just getting started. It's only been a few years. It's only been a few years that the church was established there. And we don't seem to have a real detailed government structure here. There's no mention of the pastors and things. There's no mention of a real, you know, fully developed structure. And so my impression is that we're not talking about something really big yet. And again, I certainly won't be dogmatic about this. Because we really don't have enough detail to know. And the fact that people are meeting in different... See, they're talking about homes... and a meeting in homes, and it may be that they're meeting in more than one home, and that there are some things going on along those lines, but it doesn't look like we've got a fully developed church system where you've got one major home church and a lot of satellite churches, at least yet at this point. In Galatia, Galatia is perhaps more a situation where there were a number of different cities in Galatia, and he's addressing a whole area there. He's not addressing a particular city. And I think you've got a good example there that we are talking about several different individual assemblies.
Like Corinth,
yeah, no doubt they were not building church buildings. They were meeting in either homes and that may be part of the problem there. If they didn't have a home that was big enough for everybody, then they would have to be meeting individually, and that perhaps could also aid and abet some of the division elements, because the people that wanted to be of Apollos, you know, they went over to this house, you know.
I don't think so, because if you have a couple hundred people, I know there's a couple hundred people like in one home.
Yeah, yeah. And that makes you wonder, well, what is this feast that they were having? You know, they may have chosen a place, and it may have even been outdoors, as far as we know, where they rented a hall or something, rented one of the heathen temples. Yeah, get all the objects out before you have the meeting. No. Okay, there is. See, now look at verse 34. We're kind of jumping ahead here, but verse 34 says, if any man hunger, let him eat at home, that ye come not together unto condemnation, and the rest will I set in order when I come. Apparently, Paul is instituting a change here and telling them, because of what you're doing here, it's best that you eat at home. If you're going to have your meal, eat that at home, so that you're not making manifest the rich and the poor and everybody here, and the way that you're added to your hearts, and then come together and have the communion elements here. So that apparently is a change that Paul's instituting here. So that may be what you've heard. In other words, because of the abuse, Paul's saying it's probably better not to get together and eat the way you are. Now, I don't think he's condemning forever that the church is never to be able to have a meal together. But I think he's saying that this is not really doing what it was supposed to do. And not that there was anything intrinsically wrong with it, but because they were manifesting things that they ought not to be, it would be better to keep the whole thing on the spiritual level, keep the whole focus on the spiritual level, and have everybody being treated the same, as it were, and to have no manifestations of the differences among them in this respect. Now, again, I don't think we're in a position today to say, well, we can never have a meal together or something. Obviously not. But if we were having the same kind of problem, the pastor might just say that. Well, we tried this, and look what happened to you. You know, from now on, we're not going to do that. We're going to do this. And I think it's a good indication of the fact that church government has to implement things in accordance with what's going on and what kinds of abuses are taking place and so forth. They may have to change the guidelines that they give on a certain area and so forth because of abuses. And it's not that there was anything intrinsically wrong with them coming together, but if they're doing it with the wrong kind of attitudes and divisions are showing up, they better do something else until they get that taken care of at least. So I think that's what he's saying. Probably, most likely they were looking to that separately. I think it's highly unlikely that they were just incorporating that all into it. That would tend to de-emphasize the symbolic importance and significance of it if it's just part of the meal. I think they did have a meal and they had whatever they had for the meal, but this was over and above that, something separate. I'm almost certain that would have to be the case to get any spiritual significance out of it. Just having a meal together wasn't the point. Communion is more than just having a meal together. Communion is more than a horizontal fellowship. It's vertical, primarily vertical, renewing that covenant, partaking of the bread from heaven, partaking of the blood of Jesus Christ. It's firstly vertical, and then as a result, it's horizontal. Because you see, in the kingdom of God, we're not a social club. It's not a matter of just everybody getting together and loving one another. There's lots of people out in the world that, you know, they call it love too. You know, it's not really the same thing, obviously, but it's not just a social club. It's not just a horizontal relationship. It is primarily a vertical relationship that has horizontal results. And if it ever gets turned around from that, and if the emphasis goes on the horizontal instead of the vertical, you march down the road to destruction. God's really clear about this. I mean, he's the head and we are the body. You can't just have a body and throw the head away. You've got to make sure that you're under the head in order to stay a part of the body. And that's part of what he's going to be talking about here, discerning Christ as the head and recognizing that that's the basis for it all. That's the basis for making a judgment as to whether or not, as to discerning what the Lord's body is. It's those that are under the head. So that vertical relationship has got to be maintained as well. So I think, I can't really prove this dogmatically. There's lots of speculation on it. All we have is what's stated here, and so there are some loopholes. So I'll give you my opinion on it. I think that they were making a separation, even though they were having a meal together, that somewhere the leadership or someone was saying, you know, let's do this unto the Lord and take this time now to be unto the Lord. It's possible they weren't. If they weren't, they would have even other problems. But I think that Paul does not really correct them about that. He's just saying, you eat your meal at home and do this unto the Lord separately because of the abuse that's happening. I don't think he's saying you weren't doing this. He wasn't chasing them for saying, you just had a meal, you didn't have communion. You were having communion, but what you thought was communion, but it really wasn't the Lord's Supper. In fact, he says something in the next verse. He said, when you come together, therefore, into one place, this is not to eat the Lord's Supper. So again, they're coming together into one place. That would again indicate this is a gathering of the whole church someplace. And he says, this is not to eat the Lord's Supper. But that's what they were gathering together to do, to eat the Lord's Supper. He says, you're not eating the Lord's Supper. See, the Lord's Supper isn't just the food that you stuff into your bellies, you know, and it's not doing it all together and having a good time. It is a holy and sanctified covenant, renewing of your covenant before the Lord and with each other. And the reason that you have a covenant with each other and the reason you have fellowship with each other is because you're all of the same Father. The reason that there's no Jew nor Greek and whatever is because you're all of one Father. And you're renewing that covenant to him, and therefore establishing it, your fellowship with one another in him. Okay, so as we read through this, I think we'll remind ourselves of these points as we go through. And of course, there is a lot of speculation and commentaries on this, and that's why I've said some of the things that they've said. Just, you know, you're drawing inferences from some of the statements. For example, you know, if any man hunger, let him eat at home. I mean, that's got some implications as far as what was going on, although the details of it weren't delineated maybe as much as we would like. I think there is a kind of a lack of detail in some of these areas, just because if more detail were given, men being what they are would lock into those details, and that's the thing that they would be observing it just like that. If God's not really so concerned about the actual mode and how it's expressed, but he's concerned about the spiritual truths involved, then it's appropriate for him to express things like this. For example, there is no statement here as to how often you are to have communion. Some people are kind of surprised by that, you know, and some people come to our church and wonder, how often do you have communion? Well, once a year, or once every 6 months. You know, and you see, in the Catholic Church, it's every, you know, the Mass is every, isn't it every Sunday, every time they go to church? In the Lutheran Church that I grew up in, it was every other Sunday you had communion. And because the emphasis is so much on the externals, that they're keeping these externals all the time, you see. But the Scripture doesn't say how often to do it. Now, that's kind of a problem. Then it's up to the church government to decide how often are we going to do this. And the church government has to make that decision on the basis of understanding what's being signified by it and considering the people, where the people are, how many new ones are coming in, and other factors that are involved. So we've made decisions, and we've done it differently. I don't think we've ever here done it real frequently. I think the most frequent is like every 3 months or something, like back when we first got started. And when we first got, I think it was several years before we even had our first communion when we first got started. And part of that was just because people were just coming out of denominations and had to learn and had to understand what the significance of some things was. Maybe I'm not right. I think it seems like back at Hartley's living room we did have it once anyway. I'm trying to remember now. I have to get a historian or something to record all these things. It's getting hard to remember now. I used to remember so much detail. Now I think back, that's been 17, 18 years now. And you find out things do get a little fuzzy. Okay, was there a question? Yes. Well, apparently Apollos did, and some of the others, they came and visited and ministered. Yeah, I think so. That's why following. Now, Cephas himself may have also, because there was a faction of Cephas. We can't necessarily prove that. They may have heard of his testimony or something like that and developed a following. But it was not unlikely for other apostles to visit. And especially, you see, part of it wasn't so much that they were trying to go in and minister, but they were traveling from place to place. And the natural place to stop would be where your brethren are and to be received and so forth. And Paul was sending Timothy around to some of these churches and so forth to see how they were and to teach and establish too. So that was not an unusual thing. It did not imply that they were coming in and trying to take over the ministry just because they happened to stop in and minister. There was one body. They wanted to emphasize the fact that they were one body all over. And Paul did talk about a man not building on another man's foundation, but he's mainly talking about a competition in the ministry, going in and trying to take over somebody's church and win their influence over to you or something like that. And none of these men were doing that. Apollos certainly wasn't doing that. The fact that there was a faction after Apollos wasn't Apollos' fault. It's just the people are carnal, and you know, they're looking to men. But I'm sure Apollos ministered to them. Okay. Now, verse 18. Then, first of all, when you come together in the church, I hear that there be divisions among you, and I partly believe it. So the first thing that he was concerned about is the existence of divisions among them. Now, this is picking up on the theme that was started back earlier in the beginning of the epistle, that there are divisions among you. Now, the word church here is ecclesia, assembly. We're all familiar with that term. So this is the assembly of the saints. We're not necessarily talking about a church building here, but you're gathered together in the assembly, wherever they were, happened to be being assembled here. And he says that there are divisions among you. Excuse me. The Greek word for divisions is schismata. Schismata, S-C-H-I-S-M-A-T-A. S-C-H-I-S-M-A-T-A, schismata. We get the word schisms from that, divisions. He says, I partly believe it. Now, Paul is giving them some benefit of the doubt, hoping that all that he has heard isn't really so. In other words, he's heard a lot about the divisions, and he's probably saying, I partly believe it, because he's saying, well, I've heard all these stories, all of them are saying the same thing. There must be some ground to it, but I realize that people exaggerate things too, and that I may not be getting everything straight, and therefore he says I partly believe it. He strongly suspects that much of it is so, otherwise he wouldn't be giving the kind of admonition he's giving. And yet on the other hand, he is giving them the benefit of the doubt too. Okay, that's our last bell, so we'll have to talk about the nature of these divisions. And again, we've talked about this before, but we'll get some more comment on this here.